So, as I mentioned last week, I wanted to continue this week with the topic of the paradox of self, not self, and how the Buddha teaches this and works with it, explains it. And the main way he's done this is something called the five aggregates of clinging. And it's in some way it's like last week we talked about the the six sense doors, and the idea being when you really look at what's going on, all that's ever going on is there's these things arising at the sense doors, but there's no me there. It's just stuff arising and passing away. And the five aggregates of clinging approaches that same idea, but from a very different angle. This is also the thing the Buddha spoke about more than anything else, this particular teaching. In the Samyutta Nikaya that I'll be reading from later on, which is Samyutta means collected, right? So in the collected discourses, the largest collection is 159 suttas on the five aggregates of clinging. So he's tried a lot of different ways to explain this and approach it in different ways and use different analogies and images. And it's you'll see, because I'll read several of those things later on. But first of all, I wanted to start with the word aggregate, the five aggregates of clinging. First of all, in Pali, that word is khanda, and in Sanskrit, it's skanda. And literally, what that means, what the word means, is a heap or a pile. So this is like the five piles of stuff, which might be an interesting thing. But the key here is that he calls this the five aggregates of clinging. This is the five piles of stuff that we continually keep clinging to. And I like the word heap or pile, because it sort of describes, in some sense, the messiness of this. It's just piles of stuff. It's just, but as you know, everything, as you'll see as I start going through this, everything you can conceive of fits in one of these five piles. That's the important point that the Buddha keeps making in a variety of ways. I want to start this. This is from actually from the Majjhima Nikaya, and this is just he's talking about the word aggregates. This is the Buddha actually talking about. But Venerable Sir, in what way does the term aggregates apply to the aggregates? So what do you mean by a bunch of heaps of stuff? It's basically, and he's talking to a Brahmin here. Bhikkhu. Any kind of material form, whatever, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, this is the material form aggregate. So he's being very, like, it's everything. Everything is like, it doesn't have to be something you can just see right in front of you. It can be far or near. It could be gross or subtle, internally or externally, which is in the words that he uses also in the Satipatthana Sutta, talking about what we experience, what we seem to experience inside, and what we seem to experience outside. They're all the form aggregate. But then he goes on and lists for this same thing for the other four aggregates. I also want to read, actually now I'm going to read the actual sutta, Satipatthana Sutta, where this is clearly taught. So this, the five aggregates of clinging, besides being all these things in the Samyutta Nikaya, is also one of the dhammas, the fourth foundation of mindfulness that appears in the Satipatthana Sutta. So it's one of the contemplations that we have to progress through as we deepen our practice. And this is actually quite brief and pithy. He knows such is material form, such its arising, such its passing away. Such is feeling tone, such its arising, such its passing away. Such is cognition or perception, such its arising, such its passing away. Such are volitions, such their arising, such their passing away. Such is consciousness, such its arising, such its passing away. That's it. Five things. And what we're trying to be aware of is the fact that they're arising, but all equally important that they're all passing away. That these are all transient things. They arise and then they pass away. And he emphasizes that over and over again. He says, so now let's. So we, and part of that idea of arising and passing away means that we're seeing everything that's arising in any of these five heaps, anything that's there in any of these five heaps is impermanent because it's arising and it's passing away. Equally important that we see the arising and the passing away. But what are these five aggregates? The first one is material form. So this is anything. But this is, it's a very broad thing, and I'll talk more about that later. So it isn't just applied to like solid material things, but also to the sensations, physical sensations we experience when we are interacting with material things. And as you said in the other place in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's like, it doesn't have to be something I'm even actually physically interacting with. It's something that I can see it way over there on the horizon. It's still a material thing. You know, or I know it's there because I saw it there before. It's still a material thing. I saw it in the past, or I imagine it in the future. So anything that has materiality or is interacting with, we have experienced things with our five senses. That's all form. And then the interesting thing is everything else has to do with mental formations. So he's like, there's material stuff and then there's mental stuff. And that's it. So that's the dividing line one. So the next heap, the next pile is Vedana. Vedana is a Pali word, usually translated as something like feeling tone. So it isn't feelings like emotions. It's feeling tone, which basically has three valences. It has, it's present, pleasant, it's unpleasant, it's neutral. So we experience things, and that's what we feel before anything else. The first thing we experience when anything arises at any of the sense doors is we experience Vedana, this mental formation that basically classifies everything we're experiencing as pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's it. And this is important, and I'll talk more about that later. It's such a simple thing, right? Then the third aggregate, sometimes called cognition, sometimes called perception. And so perception is the process where something arises, some form arises, Vedana arises, and then we go through this process of essentially identifying and naming it. Oh, that's a piece of wood. Yep, that's, you know, these are headphones. You know, that's Jeff over there. Whatever it is, we have labels we put on things. And that's what perception, which is another precise mental formation that always is happening. Something arises at one of the sense doors, Vedana arises, and then perception occurs. It's what allows us to function in the world. If we couldn't perceive things, we wouldn't be able to like move, because we would walk into walls. We wouldn't know what was going on, right? So perception is like this continuous process, continuous in the sense that it's with every sense impression, perception arises. And then the next category, the fourth heap, is often called mental formations. And this is like everything else that arises at the mental level. So if, in particular, you'll see this in some places, they'll talking about volitional process or intentions. And that's because they're so important in understanding the Buddhist teachings. But this is really anything that arises at the mental level other than vedana and perception. So those are separated out, and this is like everything else that arises at the mental level. So this includes moods and emotions and all kinds of other things like that, memory. And then the last one is this broad term called consciousness. And consciousness is just the function that goes on that makes us aware of the other four. That's the simplest way to describe it, and I'll talk more about consciousness as we go along. But consciousness is the process whereby we perceive, we see, we know that the other four skandhas are operating. It sort of sits on top of them in a sense. And the idea being that if you start to look at these five heaps and you start thinking, well, where is the self in there? Where's the I? Where's the me? So even on an intellectual level, we can sort of go, I don't, there's no I there. There's no thing called me, self, there at all. It's just things arising that we notice that have relationship to these five heaps of stuff. That's all that's ever going on. Okay, so now we're gonna shift gears a little bit here. This is the Samyutta Nikaya. You can see I got six different tabs in here tonight, so we may get to all six, we may not. But this is the section of the Samyutta Nikaya where the Buddha speaks directly about the five aggregates of clinging. And this is once again, this is a householder asking the Buddha questions. He says, yeah. We would be, and this is the, he says, we would come from far away, Venerable Sir, to learn the meaning of this statement from the Venerable Sariputta, who had just taught the five aggregates. But could you explain it a bit more in detail? Yes, Venerable Sir, said. Now, householder, is one of, how, householder, is one afflicted in body and afflicted in mind. Here, householder, the uninstructed worldling, it's a phrase you see a lot in the sutta, the uninstructed worldlings, that's us. Okay, we're the or maybe we're a little bit instructed, perhaps, who knows? Who is not a seer or of the noble ones, and is unskilled and undisciplined in their Dhamma, who is not a seer of superior persons, and is unskilled and disciplined in their Dhamma, regards form as self, or self as possessing form, or form as in self, or self as in form. These are four ways we create our sense of a separate self. He lives obsessed by the notions, I am form, form is mine. And as he lives obsessed by these notions, that form of his changes and alters. With the changes and alterations of form, there arise in him sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair. So what he's saying is how we create our own suffering is we cling to the sense that this form is me. And we do it in four. I want to just repeat this section where these four different ways you might do this, because it's interesting. He says, regarding form as self, so this is me, or self as possessing form, I possess this form. So it's sort of like from the other side of the coin, right? or form as in self, or self as in form. So he's covering all the bases and saying, here's different, slightly different ways we think about this self, this physical body, as being me. And then he goes on to say, and by doing that, we solidify around it, I am form. Form is mine. It's like, and then we suffer. So that's the main idea. And then, of course, Sariputta goes on and gives exactly the same speech about the other four aggregates, which the aggregates of clinging are very repetitive in their teaching style. But so let's look a little more closely at these aggregates. And one way you can do this is you can think of material form as anything that's affected by external conditions. So anything that's affected by heat or cold, wet or dry, calm or windy, whatever those conditions might mean, anything that's connected to or ex affected by any external condition is a kind of form. And what we don't see, and this is where we start to, when we start clinging to form, we have these sensations, right? We have a sensation of it's my foot is hot. I got thick socks on or something, right? Quickly leads to the it's quickly we have the all we all we're feeling is a sensation of heat. But when we cling, we then get to the point where it's my foot is hot, which is we've gone through perception into possession. Like we felt that heat down there, and really all we're feeling is the heat. We're feeling, or my chin is itchy. Well, now it's the same thing. It's like really all we're feeling is that sort of tingling sensation that itch has. That's all that's ever really going on, is we're having these sensations, but we conceptualize around them and then possess them. This is why how clinging to form causes us trouble over and over again. Something from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness, here. And he's talking about this first aggregate. This is, and he's saying, this is a more profound instruction than we might at first realize, because it leads us to the level of concept. Body, head, chest, arm, leg, foot, to the level of direct experience. We may think that we're feeling the foot or leg, but there's no sensations called foot. It is only when we go past the concept to what we're actually feeling that we can apply the next instruction. Here one knows such is material form, such its arising, such its passing away. So what he's saying here is in the sutta, what the sutta is saying is you can actually note simply what skanda you're experiencing at any moment. And turn it, instead of making something into a foot or a desk or a chair or whatever you're making it into, all you're doing is if you can just be aware at the level of, oh, this is material form, and it's arisen, and sure enough, there it is, and now it's passing away, which is all like all sensations do. One of the most deluding aspects of concepts is that the concepts themselves don't change. We use the same word, head, body, man, woman, whether it's today, yesterday, or tomorrow. The word remains the same, which reinforces the illusion that there's something permanent that these words refer to. Yet when we contemplate the first aggregate of material elements, we clearly experience their changing nature. All of these sensations are in constant flux and change. So he's pointing to the importance of us seeing that material form is always is totally impermanent. So how could a self be there when it's totally impermanent? Everything that we're experiencing at the level of material form is totally impermanent. So it's like we can't realize, we can't make a self out of something that's changing and not there. There's nothing to hold on to. Okay. Then we go on to Vedana, feeling tone. And basically, Vedana is every time something arises at any of the sense doors, immediately following that, Vedana arises. It's the first mental formation after we actually sense something. Before we perception arises, before we figure out what it is, it's just like there's that raw sensation, and then Vedana arises, and it's one of, I said, it's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. That's it. And the thing we have to understand is Vedana arises not dependent on the object itself, but on the causes and conditions at the time that thing arises. We somehow start to attach the idea of pleasant to particular things. Like, oh, Haagen-Dazs coffee ice cream, pleasant, right? We attach that Vedana to an object. But Haagen-Dazs coffee ice cream might be pleasant sometimes, but other times if you've already had two bowls, the third bowl probably isn't going to be pleasant anymore. It might be neutral, it might even be unpleasant, your favorite thing, but now it's become unpleasant. So it's like we have to understand that Vedana is separate from the object itself. It's a mental arising that comes after we experience the object itself. It's a separate thing. And actually, I want to read something from this Guy Armstrong's book, Emptiness. And I wonder, he has some things to say about this as well. Actually, just a funny little story he tells about what some people find pleasant, other people find unpleasant. Same experience, but everybody, depending on the causes and conditions, different experiences. This is a convenience store in Southern California was having a problem with drug dealers in this parking lot. The presence of the dealers and their customers was keeping away paying customers. The store manager would call the police, who would ask the group to leave, but soon they would come back. Then the store manager had an idea. Why not play some music over the store's outdoor loudspeakers? He started playing tracks of Mantovani. Now, some of you might be too young to know who Mantovani is, but Mantovani was this sort of really schmaltzy stringed instrument stuff that was very popular in the 60s. Maybe it's still popular now. I haven't heard it in a long time, but it's sort of like slightly above Muzak, but only slightly. Okay. A conductor who used the sounds of swelling strings to dramatize movie scores in the 50s and 60s. My mother was fond of Mantovani, so I heard a lot of it growing up. To her, the sound was very pleasant. However, the drug dealers did not find it at all pleasant, and they soon cleared out. Same experience, totally different Vedana. And this is something we have to understand, that it's just based on causes and conditions, we experience something, and then the Vedana arises totally based on what was happening in that moment. It's a separate thing. Okay. And then the third of these is perception or cognition. And this is basically just the process of labeling what has arisen based on past experience. You see something, you recognize the shape, you recognize the color. Oh, it's red, it's sort of roundish. Oh, it's an apple. That's what perception does. It's sort of based on the sense impression, which originally was just object. We classify it. And we classify all this based on memory. So we remember some other object that was like that, and then we know, oh, that's an apple. But the first time when you were like, 6 weeks old and someone held an apple up in front of you, it'd just be blob. You wouldn't know it was an apple because you hadn't had that experience of naming it and giving it. And the other thing about the thing about perception is it's incredibly inaccurate. And that's because what happens when we see something that we've never seen before? It's like, often it really throws us for one thing. It's like, what the heck was that? And then we're busily, our mind is busily trying, scanning through our memory. Oh, what, no, it's not that. No. Trying to figure what the heck it was based on previous perceptions. So if we don't have any previous perceptions, we don't know what it is, but we typically stick it someplace in one of the categories we know. And we think we saw an apple, but actually it was just a pile of red sludgy paper that looked like an apple from a distance. But we perceived it as an apple because that's that round object. It's red. Oh, it must be an apple. That's what we do all the time. Incredibly inaccurate. This is why, when something happens, a crime happens, and police interview all the bystanders, they get like seven different views of what happened. So, the guy was short, tall, white, black, wearing a red hoodie. No, the hoodie was definitely black. Blah 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 blah. So perception is inaccurate. It's also, in some level, based on our own memories, but also on our biases. Like we see something happen, a crime happen, and because we think, criminals who do violent things must be men, we identify that person as a man. We perceive a man when it could just be a tall, thin woman with a hoodie on. But we say definitely it was a man because we believe our perceptions. We're all experts, we think, at perceiving things. And actually, we're not at all. And it causes trouble. Here's more Joseph Goldstein on this topic. And talking about the perception of solidity. When we don't observe the five aggregates carefully, there's one deeply habituated perception that we have about the world and ourselves that becomes the origin of many inaccurate conclusions. It's the perception that keeps us from understanding what is true. This is the perception of we have of the solidity of things. We believe in the solidity of material phenomena, in the solidity or stability of relationships, of societies. But as long as this perception of solidity and stability is fixed, we don't deeply understand the impermanent and insubstantial nature of all phenomena. Why is this perception of solidity so strongly conditioned in our view of reality? One reason is the rapidity of the changes taking place. Things are moving so quickly that we don't see the discontinuities. For example, when we go to a movie, we don't see the separate frames of film. This is back when movies were actually still in frames of film, right? They are moving quickly enough across the screen that all the images flow seamlessly into one another. But when we see an electric light, we see the light as continuous rather than the flow of electrons through a filament. Another reason we don't see the insubstantial nature of phenomena is because we are usually observing things from a distance, and so not seeing their composite nature. If we look at a hillside from a distance, all we see is a mass of color. As we come closer, we begin to see individual trees, then parts of trees, and then on a cellular or molecular level, no trees at all. On this level, the perception of solidity, even of tree, has disappeared. This is the same with all objects of experience. They seem solid only from our one limited perspective. For this reason, the view of solidity is called a hallucination of perception. I like that phrase, that hallucination of perception, which is what we have lots of in our daily life. Okay, anyhow, that's. And then we have, as I said, the fourth heap is all mental formations except Vedana and perception, which has been, and they've been separated out because they're so important, right? The problems of selfing is most obvious when we look at how we use language around these mental formations. And I talked about this somewhat last week. We make a sense of I by the language we use, mentally or verbally, about these mental formations as they arise. I am happy, I am sad. Instead, we need to try happiness has arisen or sadness has arisen. This helps us see the impermanent, insubstantial nature of these mental states, that they arise due to external conditions and then pass away, that they are impermanent, just like everything else. Often you'll see in talks about this particular skanda, volition and intention are particularly important and separated out even more because they give this idea that I'm in charge. I am in charge. We think we're in charge. And it arises because we have this mental formation of intention arising. I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. I'm going to reach out and touch the screen and I'm going to pull my arm back or whatever it is our intentions are. Everything, every action of speech and body is volitional. It has to have intention behind it. If there's no intention, no mental formation of intention, nothing happens. So it's an interesting way to explore the idea that these are mental formations that are just arising, and then they, because I get the mental formation, I'm going to touch the screen, my hand goes out, now that mental formation is gone. It's arisen and then it's gone away. Just like that. Boom, it's gone. And over and over and over and over again, this is exactly what's happening. Every time we're doing anything in the world, whether through speech or through body. Okay, then we come to consciousness. This is, for me, the one I have the most difficulty with, I'll be honest with you. So it's interesting to take time with this one. So consciousness is, you see this definition, that which knows. And we identify with this aggregate because it seems continuous. It seems like somehow I have consciousness. It's like some permanent thing I have that's being aware of all this other stuff that's going on. Not, all those other things might be changing. My consciousness is always there. That's how we permanent it that way. But actually what's happening is something's arising at a sense door. Vedana arises, perception arises. Some sort of volitional formations might arise. And then consciousness of that object is there. But then it's gone, just like that, because now there's another one, and another one, and another one. And there, and because things are arising at all the different sense doors, then we can only be aware of one thing at a time. It seems like consciousness is continuous, but actually it's a bunch of tiny little discrete moments of consciousness of something arising at the ear sense door, and then something arising at the eye sense door, and then something arising at the mental sense door, and that's all that's ever going on. There's not any continuity or solidity to consciousness even. But this is hard to see because it's we resist it because we're so used to clinging to this idea of, well, I know I'm there. I'm sure I'm there. That consciousness is like some solid thing, right? And it's the thing about consciousness, this is once again, it's directly affected all the time by causes and conditions. Things arise due to causes and conditions, and then the consciousness arises based on what happened just before it made them arise. And it's this loop that's always going on, but it's not in any sense a continuous, permanent thing. It's a bit more Guy Armstrong. And he's talking about this issue of how we make things solid that we're perceiving at some basic level. From our own innate tendencies and the repeated use of language, we have adopted, without reservation, the belief that the body, thoughts, and feelings are me. And everything outside the body is not me. This fundamental sense of duality creates a split in our experience that leads us to feel disconnected from the rest of creation, which with the consequent feelings of loneliness, isolation, anxiety, and longing. We are examining the belief in a self in order to see through this duality, because beyond it is the promise of much greater wholeness and connection. To see fully the emptiness of self, we need to look into all the corners of our being, because the sense of self is very good at appearing to be reformed while merely finding subtler places to take a new birth. The Buddha often used the five aggregates as the model to offer through analysis of the myriad ways we identify as self, as well as the way out of identification. So he's pointing to the importance of this process, and it is a process. And it is actually something, at times when you're sort of focused and still, when you can start to actually see things from the point of view. I mean, the five aggregates of clinging is basically, let's look at everything from this point of view and see if we can sort of note as we're sitting, oh, that's form, that's vedana, that's perception, oh, that's consciousness, oh, there was consciousness. And just see if we can separate things out and see them as such. It's see, because everything is just flowing so continuously, it seems like just one long stream, and we don't see the little pieces of it. And start to understand what's actually going on, which is nothing is going on except things are changing. And there's no me in this flow at all. There's no self there. Right, where'd I put that book? Ah, right here in front of me. Okay, so now I have some other selections from the Samyutta Nikaya I want to do. And this is. I want to do this because the Buddha uses all these different images and ways of explaining, and sometimes, one of these images might sort of strike you as, oh, that makes sense. I see that. So this is Bhikkhu, suppose there was a mountain river sweeping downwards, flowing into the distance with a swift current. If on either bank of the river kasa grass or kusa grass were to grow, it would overhang it. If rushes, reeds, or trees were to grow, they would overhang it. So this is like describing a typical mountain scene in North India. If a man being carried along by the current could grasp the kusa grass, it would break off and he would thereby meet with calamity and disaster. If he should grab the kusa grass or etc., it would break off and he would meet with disaster. So what he's this, so the image here is we are constantly in this flowing stream, and we keep reaching out and grabbing onto things to try and somehow stop the stream. Somehow, oh no, I don't want to be in this flow anymore. But every time we grab something, because they're all impermanent, they all break off and down the stream we go some more. There's no way to stop being in the stream. This stream of things arising, the five aggregates being always there, and just flowing along, changing, 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 changing all the time. It's just an interesting image because it's like this image of the stream is something that's recurring in Buddhist teaching over and over in many different places. Yes, here's another one. Have to find the right page here because I somehow lost my little marker. 77. Ah, there it is there. Okay. Here's the Buddha's talking about how we can work skillfully with these things that arise. Bhikkhus, whatever is not yours, abandon it. Was talking to Kevin the other day on Tuesday night when I was teaching about the word abandon and how this word is something that is used all the time. Whatever is not yours, abandon it. When you have abandoned it, that will lead to your welfare and happiness. And what is it, bhikkhus, that is not yours? Form is not yours. Abandon it. When it is abandoned, it will lead to your welfare and happiness. Feeling tone is not yours. And he goes through the list of the five skandhas. So he's saying we think these things are all mine. But if we can just abandon them. The word abandon is, as I said, you see this a lot in the sutta. So I looked up abandon in the dictionary, right? So, and the actual definition is give up completely a course of action, a practice, or a way of thinking. Give up completely. So, to stop clinging, we have to give up completely the idea that these things are clingable, that we can actually hold on to them because they're permanent. Because they can't hold on to them because they're not permanent. We're swept down the stream again. We have to abandon our habits of clinging to the aggregates. It's really okay. So let's go on here. Number four. And this is an interesting point too. And this is the Buddha talking to someone. But Vembasura, what is the cause and condition for the defilement of beings? How is it that beings are defiled with cause and condition? So why is it that what arises and causes and conditions when we get caught all the time? If Mahali, that's the guy he's talking to, this form were exclusively suffering, immersed in suffering, steeped in suffering, and if it were not also steeped in pleasure, beings would not become enamored with it. But because form is pleasurable, immersed in pleasure, steeped in pleasure, and not steeped only in suffering, beings become enamored with it. He's just saying, the reason we get enamored by it, the reason we cling to it, is because it's pleasant. Duh. But it's like, it's sort of, It's sort of obvious, but he's saying if everything was full of suffering all the time, which is how you see sometimes Buddhism is taught, everything is suffering. Well, no, it isn't. Sometimes things are full of suffering, and sometimes they're quite pleasurable. And we cling to the pleasurable. That's why, how we keep getting caught over and over again. By being enamored with it, they are captivated by it, and being captivated by it, they are defiled. This Mahali is the cause and condition for the defilement of beings. It is thus that beings are defiled with cause and condition. Cause and condition, things arise. So part of the reason we get caught is there's pleasant stuff out there. Just an interesting, what's in an interesting way to think about it. Ah. Oh, we asked about time. I'm just going to skip this one and go on to the next one. It's like I said, there's so much material here. Here he's talking about the fact that this whole idea of not self, of not having a self, it's really scary sometimes. When you think about it, it's like, what? Who am I if I'm not myself, right? Here, because the uninstructed worldling becomes frightened over an unfrightening matter. For this is frightening to the uninstructed worldling. It might not be, and it might not be for me. It will not be, and it will not be for me. In other words, the opposite of those four before. It's like, they're like, who knows? I don't, I mean, that's not mine. I mean, I can't cling to this. It's an idea that people find upsetting, that there's no, because we have to sort of, get used to that idea. It's like that thing I read last week about the image that Joseph uses of jumping out of an airplane and then realizing you don't have a parachute, and then going, oh my God, I don't have a parachute, no self, oh no, and then realizing that there's no ground. Who cares if there's no parachute? You're not going to land on anything anyway because there's nothing to land on. And that's what he's trying to point out here. We keep getting caught in the fear of not self, of the idea of not having a separate, of not being a separate being, not having a separate self. And it's something that we have to be aware of when we start working in this world, in this area, because it's not uncommon at all for this that fear to arise in the midst of a longer practice. So, I think that's enough of the suttas for tonight. I do have, of course, a little bit of poetry here just to finish off. This is from Dana Fald's book, Going In. I suspect you've heard me read this before, but it's one of my favorites because it talks very directly about this idea of not having a separate self. It's called Touch Me. Touch me as if you seek to find the core of my desire. Come to me like wind before a summer storm. Blown open, I close no doors against the breeze. Dance with me beneath the low clouds. Find me within you, above you, beside you. When the rain finally falls, I cannot tell where you end and I begin. That's a description of an experience of non-self.